This podcast on Sports360AZ.com is brought to you by your Valley Hyundai dealers. We appreciate the Valley Hyundai dealers and their support.
Now, the Brad Sesmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
And hearty good morning on this Wednesday. Jeff Munn from ASU Women's Basketball and Phoenix Rising FC, and for Brad. By the way, I've done this show before, and I always open by saying Jeff Munn with ASU Women's Basketball. At some point, if you're not aware of what I do, I'll explain it, and it's a humorous story, and we'll get to that. But I am in for Brad today. Brad is off. He mentioned on yesterday's show that his wife, Chris, suffered a broken wrist. Ouch. And she's at the doctor today, and Brad's with her, and that's where he should be, and we're happy to pinch hit to allow him to do that. We have a very, very good show for you today. We always have a good show on this show, thanks to the work of our producer, Eric Sorensen, who will magically pop up in the corner of the screen any second now. And among the guests we will have, AZ Central and Arizona Republic writer, Cardinals beat writer Kent Summers will weigh in on whether or not Adrian Peterson's got anything left. Have the Cardinal players tuned Bruce Arians out? And a few thoughts, too. We'll try to get in a little bit of this London trip, because it's now it becomes kind of an odd deal with this trip to London. Our friend Kendra D. St. Aubin, who is my go-to person on soccer, and yes, there's a little bit to talk about soccer in the United States today. Kendra, by the way, in addition to have worked here in the Valley for many years in the media, is the color analyst on television for Minnesota United FC, the expansion team in Major League Soccer, and she works an awful lot of soccer for Fox Sports, and I'm almost certain she'll be involved in their coverage of the World Cup next year. Top of the hour, our Talk to the Lopes segment, Jordan Hamm and Haley Stesiak will talk with senior guard Casey Benson. This is a young man out of Corona del Sol who transferred to Canyon from the University of Oregon. And following that will be our Friday night 360 AZ preview show with Jordan and Haley. So we got a lot to get to today. And as I said, my buddy Eric Sorensen, we can bring Eric Sorensen up in the E-box, which is what I call it. Can we do that?
Of course.
Okay.
And I should be magically appearing here.
There
right
is
now.
Eric in the E-box. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. You and I are sort of wearing matching shirts today.
Well, there's a story behind this shirt. This is from the Karsten Golf Course at Arizona State University. There's the pitchfork. There is Adidas. Where is the Adidas? There is the Adidas.
It looks like Nevada Wolfpack meshed with UCLA Bruins.
Nevada Wolfpack? Why would Nevada Wolfpack be involved?
Look at your shirt. I mean, you know.
That's a little inside baseball, kids. Only Eric and I know the
significance
of that.
Oh, wow. I just caught that. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
You just caught that. All right. First of all, you guys have been on a roll lately. I mean, you come on the air like 20 minutes after the Adrian Peterson trade, and you have Peter King. I just hope I don't kind of slow down your momentum here today.
Timing is everything, Mon.
Isn't it true? And we're going to start out, and I want you to stay with me on this for a minute,
okay.
Eric. The news of the day starts locally with a story that really isn't a story yet, and maybe it won't be, and I think a lot of people here would hope it's not. But the Boston Red Sox announced this morning that manager John Farrell will not be coming back in 2018. I don't think anybody's shocked at that news. But it's the thoughts on Twitter, and I have Twitter on my phone, and I could go onto it, and maybe I will in a minute. But already in Boston, and I heard it this morning on ESPN as well on SportsCenter, there's a little bit of chatter. When you start talking about people who might replace John Farrell, this may be shocking to those of you who are D-back fans. There are people in Boston, there are people with ESPN that have not necessarily floated the name Torey Lovullo as a replacement, but they have said it is unfortunate for the Red Sox that Torey Lovullo is not with them anymore, or he would be the automatic replacement for John Farrell. If you remember a couple of years ago when John Farrell contracted cancer, successfully beat it, he did take time off from the club, and Torey Lovullo served as interim manager, and everybody around the Red Sox said the team responded very well to Lovullo's managing, his leadership, and obviously that transferred over to what he did this year with the Diamondbacks. Now, does that mean that the Red Sox are targeting Torey Lovullo as their next manager? Well, as of this morning, the answer to that question is no. And the thing to keep in mind, and we talked this morning with people within baseball, And managers have been traded before. Their contracts have been moved to another club in the past. Lou Piniella was essentially traded from Tampa Bay to the Chicago Cubs back in the late 2000s. It happened. It has happened before. Chuck Tanner was traded as a manager way back in the 70s. Torey Lovullo is under contract. If the Red Sox were to pursue something with Torey Lovullo, there would have to be compensation. And the baseball people we spoke to this morning told us they think that any discussion, were it to ever take place, would have to involve, from the D-backs' point of view, third baseman Rafael Devers, their top prospect. Now, having said all that, and I want to be very clear about this, I am not saying that Torey Lovullo is about to jump ship and go back to Boston. That's not, I'm trying to get the logos out of here because they're not a sponsor. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that you may hear some chatter on Twitter, and already people, Red Sox fans, are on Twitter this morning saying, gee, I wish we had held on to Torey Lovullo. Right now, the early betting line money, I hate using that term, is on Brad Ausmus, the recently departed manager of the Detroit Tigers, because Dave Dombrowski is the president of baseball operations for the Red Sox. He hired Ausmus in Detroit. And so a lot of people are coming to the conclusion that it would be Ausmus's job to turn down. But there is a possibility, it has happened in the past, that a team would look into the availability of a manager who's under contract, and obviously it would require compensation. I'm just gonna add one little addendum to this, and again, I want to preface this. We're not suggesting in any way that Torey Lovullo is leaving, but it's just something that may come up in conversation. Devers is a third baseman, and obviously the D-backs pretty well set at third base, but they also have a young outfielder, Andrew Benintendi, who was their prospect of the year in 2016. The Red Sox have traded a number of their prospects away. In fact, they traded their two best prospects last winter to get Chris Sale. So their farm system isn't really loaded. So even if the Red Sox wanted to call the D-backs and say, what would you want for us to get his contract? And the other thing is Torey Lovullo would obviously have to sign off on it and say, I want to go back. And I don't
get
that
indication. Not to interrupt you, Mon, but what do you think Torey Lovullo was thinking when he saw that John Farrell will not be back as the Red Sox manager, considering the job Lovullo did filling in that managerial role and his connection to that organization that sort of really gave him the platform to prove himself, which got him his first time managerial job with the Diamondbacks?
Well, first of all, the Farrell thing has been, and I think that's been rumored for quite a while. So I don't think it came as a shock to him this morning. I'm sure he's been in communication with John Farrell. The two are very close.
Yep.
I don't know, because I will say this. He's been focused entirely on managing the Arizona Diamondbacks, and he's done a fabulous job. I've never heard him talk very much about his feelings about the Red Sox. But let's just keep this in mind. And again, I really don't want to get too deep in this for fear of upsetting people at Diamondback saying he's saying Lovullo's going to leave. I'm not saying that. But it is the Boston Red Sox. There's a history. There's a tradition. He's a part of it. He's a very popular figure in Boston. So all I'm saying is somebody going to try to float the idea that maybe the Red Sox would call the D-backs about Lovullo? Yeah, that's possible. But in no way. I think the if you had to put a percentage on the idea that he would leave, I think it's still very low single digits. I just don't see how that happens. But I think it is going to be a topic, at least in sports talk radio, in the hub over the next couple of days. A couple of other things locally I want to get to, and we'll delve into them later on in the show. Kent Summers will be coming up in our next segment. The Coyotes lost last night at Vegas to the Vegas Golden Knights. But kudos to Rick Tocchet and the entire organization. They participated in the pregame ceremonies honoring the victims of the Las Vegas shooting and the first responders, and they did a fabulous job. Vegas scored four goals in the first 10 minutes. I tweeted out last night, Gretzky's Oilers would have had no chance last night against Vegas. And they've started out, they're setting records. They're 3-0, which is a first for an NHL expansion team. But there was so much emotion last night, and the Coyotes handled it with grace, with class, and they deserve a salute from all of us for the way they handled things last night. And I wouldn't come to any conclusions about the what kind of team the Coyotes have this year based on that game last night, because nobody was beating Vegas last night. And Vegas, too, deserves a lot of credit. They said this, that was their inaugural home game of the regular season, and obviously the first Major League sports event involving a team that calls Las Vegas home. But the management said, in light of the tragedy, we are going to use that game to honor the victims, thank the first responders. There were no advertisements on the boards. Everything said Vegas strong. And they've said, we're going to treat Friday night against the Detroit Red Wings as our debut game. That's going to be the party. And I think that's a tremendous decision on their part. They did a great job with the ceremony. Just a fabulous work all the way around. Obviously, more reaction to the Adrian Peterson trade. It's just my feeling. I know you and Brad talked about this yesterday, Eric. My feeling on AP is this. I really don't think this is Emmett Smith or Edgerrin James, although they did have good, productive stretches with the Cardinals. Something tells me Adrian Peterson's got something left. I could be wrong. I could be way wrong. But I think he's got a little bit something left to prove, and it'll be interesting to see what he's able to do starting this Sunday against Dirk Cutter's Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Here comes Dirk again. Dirk's got a pretty good football team, too.
Yeah, you hate to say that this is a must win, but...
Oh, it is.
The way, I mean, I know, I understand the NFC West is not the juggernaut so far for NFL football, but when you look ahead to what is coming up for the Cardinals, you know, like Brad and I talked about this money, I mean, they've beaten two of the worst teams in football,
right,
both in overtime. They've scored three touchdowns in their last three games, and you just have to wonder if there is even just a little bit of a crack inside that locker room, because this is not how I think any of us expected the season to go.
Like, no.
A nail biter at home against the 49ers in a game that they could have very easily lost. If Tyrann Mathieu doesn't have that interception in overtime against the Colts, who knows? Maybe the Colts go down, win the game. And it's just interesting to look at. They were not competitive against the Lions. They were not competitive in Philly. Is that sort of a trend for what we're going to see on the road from this team moving forward?
Well, and that game, the next game after Tampa Bay, is that London game against the Rams.
Tricky game. It's tricky for both teams.
Well,
but the Cardinals can't just say, oh yeah, we're going to beat the Rams like we usually do.
Well, and now all of
and
a sudden...
And I shouldn't say that, because the Rams actually have the Cardinals number from time to time. But
yeah. And now all of a sudden, I mean, they were nip and tuck with the Seahawks on Sunday. Now you look at that Rams team and you say, are those guys for real? They went into Dallas and beat the Cowboys. They played Seattle pretty much straight up to the end at the Coliseum. And, I mean, they're never going to say, gee, we really wish we didn't have to do this in London, because Michael Bidwell, among others, has been a huge proponent of these London games. But it is an added obstacle to have to make that trip, do all the PR things that you do when you go to London, and then tee it up and play the game. And by the way, I don't want to hear one media person in this town. Are you listening to me, Phoenix Media? If they lose in London, I don't want to hear, it was a 6:30 in the morning kickoff. Enough. Stop it. When we come back, Kent Summers will discuss the Adrian Peterson trade. We will not talk about 10 a.m. or 6:30 a.m. kickoffs. Stop it. And we'll also talk about Bruce Arians and his offense. That's next on the Brad Sesmat Show, Sports360AZ.com and AZCentral.com. Back on a Wednesday, the Brad Sesmat Show, Jeff Munn for Brad, and obviously the biggest news in Valley sports over the last 24 hours plus, the Cardinals' acquisition of Adrian Peterson from the New Orleans Saints. So, naturally, we want to get on our friend Kent Summers, Cardinals beat writer for AZCentral.com and the Arizona Republic. I think the last time I saw you was at the Final Four. You and me and Paul Jensen were trying to make each other laugh. I don't know if you remember that, Kent, but...
Yeah.
We were very successful at it, too.
Yeah, you guys don't have to try very hard.
That's true. Yeah. Listen, when I heard this news yesterday, I know a lot of people were saying, oh, it's Emmett Smith 2.0. It's Edgerrin James 2.0. And both of those guys really were at the end of the gas tank when they got here. For some reason, I don't feel that way. Does Adrian Peterson have, compared to those other two acquisitions, does he have a lot left?
Not if you talk to people in New Orleans, which I have. I mean, he was third on their depth chart. They thought he had, you know, his physical ability had really declined and didn't have much left at age 32. You know, I think the Cardinals will be happy if this is Edgerrin James, Emmitt Smith 2.0. I mean, Edgerrin James came here and gained 1,000 yards.
That's true.
A couple of seasons. And you know, Emmitt in his last year for, I mean, not that he was anywhere near his prime, Emmitt, but he did have, I don't know, 800-900 yards, and there was a season where he scored 9 or 10 touchdowns. And you look at what they're producing these days at that position, you know, they would love if Adrian Peterson could do that.
Well, and it also, when I heard about the trade, the other thing that popped into my mind was, okay, we were told initially David Johnson to be back in midseason. Is this also a sign that maybe David Johnson's injury is more severe than we first thought?
That's an interesting question that I haven't gotten an answer to yet. I hope to this afternoon when there's more availability to people here. I would imagine they'll say no, that this is a way for the Cardinals to remain competitive and to, you know, stay in the race for a playoff spot while David Johnson is out. But, you know, NFL teams, like every other professional sports teams, are so funny about revealing anything about injuries and recovery. I just don't know. You know, at one point a few weeks ago, Bruce Arians mentioned that it could be December and Christmas time before David Johnson is ready. And the way this team is playing, if they're out of it by then, you have to, you know, they have to ask themselves, is it worth bringing him back? You know, I think the Cardinals just view this as a very low or no risk. You know, a sixth-round pick, if Adrian Peterson plays up to a certain amount, you know, the prorated portion of his $700,000 salary, it's, you know, I understand this deal came around very quickly, and the Cardinals figured, well, why not? They view it as he's better than anybody we have right now.
I think I definitely agree with that. Kent Summers, Cardinals beat writer, azcentral.com and the Arizona Republic, joining us here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. One other thing about David Johnson, and we'll move on. He's had a couple of significant injuries now. Does he now have the title, not by you, but maybe on a national level, of injury-prone David Johnson?
No, I don't think so at all. You know, he finished almost all of last season, was hurt in the final game with sort of a, you know, it looked like a serious knee injury. It turned out to be something that didn't require surgery. So I don't think so at all. And this injury was a freak thing where, you know, he took a helmet to his wrist and suffered the injury. So I don't think so. You know, I think he's seen, you know, as much as they worked him last year, I think you could see him as a durable guy. If anybody at that position is in the NFL, it's so tricky. Few guys like Adrian Peterson or Chris Johnson last until they're 32.
The other thing about this, the timing of this trade, Kent, is this division is still kind of flat, in the sense that Seattle has struggled a lot. They did get a win in Los Angeles on Sunday. I think a lot of people nationally just aren't ready to embrace the Rams, as they have had a complete turnaround. So there's still a lot for the Cardinals to accomplish, even though they have struggled through the first five games.
No doubt. I mean, you look at the Cardinals and you think, okay, they've lost at Detroit, they've lost at Philadelphia, they've lost to Dallas. If they do get to a point where they're a wild card team, those losses are really going to hurt them when it comes to, you know, getting a wild card, you know, tiebreakers, for instance. But I do. I think Bruce Arians and Steve Keim and Michael Bidwell probably looked at this and thought, well, we're only a game out of first, and we haven't even played the two teams ahead of us. So certainly we're not out of it, and certainly the NFC West doesn't look like the division that it used to be 3 or 4 years ago. Seattle's still finding itself. They have offensive line problems, too, just like the Cardinals. And you're right. I think a lot of people think, okay, can the Rams are better, obviously, but can they do this for an entire season? I think, you know, San Francisco's winless, but they're, you know, they play people competitively, but they're not going to be in contention. So, yeah, I mean, it looks like a year where conceivably 9-7, you might win the division at 9-7 if you beat the right people.
Now, we talked about the Rams. Now, I believe that the London game follows Tampa Bay, correct?
Correct.
And I bring that up because certainly I know Michael Bidwell has been a proponent of these international games, and he wanted to get the Cardinals involved. And obviously, they would never say publicly, "Ooh, gee, I wish we didn't have to do this now." But I look at it now and I think it is kind of odd in a way that the NFL would have divisional opponents, especially from the NFC West. That's not exactly a one-hour flight to London from the West Coast. And I find it interesting, and I like I said, Bruce Arians, Sean McVay, they're never going to complain about it. But I wonder in the back of if either team's minds, they're saying, gee, we might have thought about if we had taken the Tampa Bay game and made that London, that might have worked out better.
Well, I think it's always, you know, until the Rams get their new stadium, they're going to be playing in London, I think, you know, once a year. And Jacksonville always seems to be there. I think there are certain teams that are, where they are in their franchise history, make them great candidates for that. So, yeah, I mean, if the Cardinals had their druthers, I'm sure, or at least the football people, they would, you know, like so much more the one-hour flight to Los Angeles and coming back, you know, and to have a short hop, especially after, you know, going to Atlanta in the preseason and Detroit and Indianapolis and last week Philadelphia. I mean, this team has had some long road trips already, but I think it'll be all right. They play at home. They leave Monday for London. You know, they have a bye after that. So I don't think this will be too taxing or grueling on them, and it certainly won't be an excuse for not beating the Rams over there.
Kent Summers from AZ Central and the Arizona Republic, Cardinals beat writer, thank you, joins us on the Brad Sesmatch Show. I'm going to bring this up, and I do it somewhat reluctantly given where we are in the schedule, but your colleague Dan Bickley has reported that he heard that there was a lot of chirping in the locker room after the loss at Philadelphia. Understandably, it was not a good performance. Some of it was directed, he says, at Bruce Arians. And it leads me to this question. Do you get the sense that there might be the first seeds of we're tuning Bruce Arians out in that locker room?
I haven't gotten that sense at all. Now, I don't know who Dan talked to or where he got that, but I haven't gotten that feeling at all. I think it was even before the Philadelphia game that maybe there were defensive players saying, "Hey, what are we doing on offense? You know, how are we going to continue to play this way, doing the same old thing?" But certainly, no one on defense had any room to talk after that Philadelphia game with the way it played. Really throughout, you know, letting Carson Wentz throw for four touchdowns and giving up so many long plays and third and long. So can't really blame Arians for it all. Now, I do think adjustments needed to be made on offense. I think there are things they can do to be more productive. I mean, I've been a little bit surprised they haven't gone to more like four wide formations, getting the ball out of Carson Palmer's hand quickly. I think that might have helped open up the run game. We haven't seen too much of that yet. So it'll be interesting going forward how they adjust with using Adrian Peterson. Do they adjust? And, you know, the thing about him is he's not a great receiver by any means. He's not a great pass protector by any means. So I think, you know, they'll use him in run situations. And I think we'll continue to see a lot of Andre Ellington in passing situations.
Just makes that game with Tampa Bay Sunday all the more interesting. Kent, I appreciate the time. Good to talk to you. Hope to see you again soon. Safe travels, my friend.
Thanks, Jeff.
Good to talk to you. Kent Summers, azcentral.com, and the Arizona Republic on the latest with Adrian Peterson and the Cardinals. And we continue along on this Wednesday on the Brad Sesmatch Show on sports360az.com and azcentral.com. Back on a Wednesday, the Brad Sesmatch Show. Jeff Munn for Brad. By the way, I mentioned this at the top of the show. Let me tell you a quick story. A couple of years ago, ASU women's basketball is in the Northeast. We had a day off, and Charlie Turner Thorne arranged for us to go to the Naismith Hall of Fame. I'm in an ASU women's basketball polo. A young man, about 8 years old, comes up to me and says, "Sir, are you a coach?" And I'd explain to him, "No, I'm a broadcaster. We're trying to win games. So, no, me coaching is not a good idea." So I should explain that. I am the radio broadcaster for ASU women's basketball. You'd have real reasons to be worried if I was a coach. Quick trivia note, too. I heard this morning. Eric, if you want to get in on this, go ahead. A very famous television show debuted on this day 42 years ago. Do you know the answer?
Of course not.
If I told you that it was a program that was on in the evening hours on a certain day of the week... Saturday night. Live.
Oh, okay.
Which was not called Saturday Night Live initially because ABC had a variety show called Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell.
Saturday Night Live has staying power, as
it
they
sure
say
does.
In the business.
First host was George Carlin. First musical guest, I'm told, was Janice Ian. That's enough of the trivia. I wanted to talk for a couple minutes about the situation involving the D-backs. And I've said all along, I think as exciting as October was, and it was, look, the stretch run in September, the wild card game was terrific. I don't think anybody needs to feel bad about the way it ended because the Dodgers are a better team. But I also have said, I think the more interesting time for this franchise will be starting when the postseason run ends. And it's now. And it's because they have so many difficult decisions to make with the roster. Brad talked about it yesterday, and he talked about it with Pedro on Monday before Game 3, Pedro Gomez. They obviously, first up, are they going to re-sign J.D. Martinez? Personally, I don't know if they can. Now, keep in mind, Ken Kendrick has always been committed to investing what he needed to invest, he and his partners, to win right away. And if they have, if they feel that re-signing J.D. Martinez makes them a World Series contender, they probably would come up with the money to re-sign J.D. Martinez. But there's also the luxury tax, and Ken Kendrick is also, like most owners in baseball, really wants to avoid paying the luxury tax if he possibly can. So while there isn't a cap in baseball, there is a luxury tax threshold, and as I said, Mr. Kendrick's trying to do whatever he can to avoid paying that tax. They also have to decide what to do with Zach Greinke. I think trading him is going to be very difficult for a couple of reasons. 4 years, $35 million each year for the remaining 4 years of the deal. And he ain't getting any younger. And I know a lot of GMs would look at his performance in the two postseason starts and say, that's a red flag. They may trade for Greinke, but the D-backs would have to eat a lot of the contract, and they probably wouldn't get much in the way of players coming back either. And then there's one other wrinkle to this, and then I'm going to get into the farm system. Let's just say hypothetically, I know Brad threw out numbers yesterday, and he said you could get J.D. Martinez for $25 million a year. Paul Goldschmidt's going to make $11.2 million next year on that really team-friendly contract he signed several years ago. He changed agents. Wouldn't be too surprising if they sign Martinez, that kind of deal, if within 10 seconds the agent's on the phone, the agent for Goldschmidt, to Derek Hall and Ken Kendrick saying, where's my money? Where's my guy's money? Goldschmidt has never made an issue out of what he gets paid, but you don't change agents just to keep the status quo. So there's that. And then let's get into what I think is another major concern, and it's one that they're aware of down at Chase Field, and that is their farm system. There's a website, MLBpipeline.com, which lists the top 100 prospects, and you're seeing it now. And if you scroll down through this, first of all, you'll see a number of Dodger prospects in just the top 30. You have to go down to 62 to find a D-back prospect, and it's their first-round pick from this year, Pavin Smith, a first baseman, very highly thought of out of the University of Virginia. And he is a first baseman, so if Paul Goldschmidt were to leave at the end of his deal, or they decided to trade him for as many prospects as they could get, that's the guy that would likely be targeted as the first baseman of the future. Then you go down to the last row, next to last row, and at 95 is right-handed pitcher John Duplantier, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name. Both of these guys are in A-ball. They're probably minimum 2 years away from the big leagues. And I get it, you know, farm prospects are a lot like draft picks. You can't totally project them out. But two things I want to say about this, and then I'm going to move on to another subject. The D-backs need to start working on building up the farm system, and they're aware of it. And the other thing is, I'm tired of people saying the Dodgers just win with a checkbook. Look at all the number of prospects they have. Look at the guys that they have on their roster right now that came out of that farm system. The checkbook's a factor, but it's not the whole factor. All right, the other thing I wanted to talk to you very quickly, talk about, is what took place Saturday between ESPN and the University of Washington. College Game Day made a big deal out of Chris Peterson's comments last week that he regrets playing late-night games. He did not specify ESPN in doing so, because all of the Pac-12 partners, ESPN, Pac-12 Network, and FS1, do games late at night on the West Coast. They call it Pac-12 After Dark. Peterson doesn't like it, obviously, because it's hard to get attention on the East Coast when you kick off at 10:45 Eastern, as they will this Saturday here at Sun Devil Stadium against ASU. He never specified ESPN, but ESPN, and this is my opinion, I thought they hit Peterson several times below the belt and after the bell, starting on College Game Day. Their host, Reese Davis, who does a nice job hosting that show, said, and this is a quote, "It certainly doesn't hurt your bank account." Now, that's something to me that you say to a first-year coach of a mediocre program. You don't say it to a guy who took Boise State to multiple BCS appearances and Washington to the college football playoff. Quick, name how many coaches have done that. Put their schools or schools in the BCS and the CFP. It's a short list. They treated Chris Peterson like he was a 25-year-old grad assistant. And then Kirk Herbstreit, who I just am a huge fan of, said two things that really irked me. Number one, he said Peterson, quote, should be thankful to ESPN for their partnership with the Pac-12. And, quote, maybe you'd be happier playing at 1 p.m. on the Pac-12 network. Both those comments, I thought, were just, they were cheap shots at Chris Peterson. And then that night during the Washington-Cal game in Seattle, Mark Jones and Rod Gilmore beat Peterson up pretty good for a while over the fact he wouldn't meet with them the day before. Here's a little known fact. Peterson doesn't talk to any TV crews the day before a game. It wasn't just them. And then during the game, Quint Kesenich, their sideline reporter, lined up three actual cupcakes on the sideline to demonstrate Washington's non-conference schedule. Now, for the record, Washington did have a very weak non-conference schedule. But I saw somebody on social media pose the question, do you think Quint Kesenich would have pulled a stunt like that in Tuscaloosa? It's just my opinion. I think ESPN really, really went over the line after Chris Peterson. They owe him an apology, and they should do it Saturday morning on College Game Day. USA Soccer. Well, I'm not going to get into it now. We'll get into it with our pal Kendra D. St. Aubin, who knows a lot more about soccer than I do, and she's next on the Brad Sesmat Show, sports360az.com, azcentral.com. On a Wednesday on the Brad Sesmat Show, Jeff Munn for Brad, and we're going to talk soccer. I'm going to get something nice out of the way first. Saturday night, 7:30, out at the Phoenix Rising Soccer Complex. The Phoenix Rising FC will play their final regular season match. They're going to the playoffs in the USL. They'll take on Portland Timbers 2 at 7:30. If you haven't been out there, get out there, because Didier Drogba, who's healthy, he's back in the lineup. He's a treat to watch all by himself. And I wish we could say the same positive things about USA Soccer, but we can't, because they lost last night to Trinidad Tobago, and they will not qualify for the 2018 World Cup. And on that happy note, we bring in our friend Kendra D. St. Aubin, who's in the Valley for many years in the media here in town. And I don't know anybody that knows more about soccer than Kendra does. She played it. She covers it. She is the color analyst for Minnesota United FC, the new expansion team in MLS. And she also works for Fox Sports on a number of matches. And there is, I've heard a number of people today already, Kendra, that are all saying the same thing. There is no way to overstate how disastrous a loss this is. Are you in agreement?
Absolutely. This, you know, I think this really actually sets soccer back in the United States. I think it makes strides, you know, it's made strides the last decade, you know, 10 to 15 years. And the World Cup is the one time where everybody gets on board with soccer. You may not watch soccer a day of your life or the entire year, and you'll tune in for World Cup soccer. So there's always that. You draw in these fans that were fringe fans or not fans at all. And they draw into the World Cup, and now there are going to be very few of those because they're doing it to watch the United States. You know, they're not going to do it necessarily to watch Brazil or Argentina or any of those things. This is a huge, massive setback. But you know what? At the same time, it could be just a clear-cut wake-up call for a system that has been broken and struggling for the past 8 to 10 years. And it's just going to force wholesale change. So it could be a blessing in disguise, and it's happened to other countries. People talk a lot about Germany in 2002 when they really struggled. They did a complete overhaul of their academy system, the club system, their pro system, Bundesliga. They did a complete overhaul, and you know, look at where they are now. They've been a powerhouse the last 8 years. So who knows? It's devastating in that sense, in a sports sense, but you know, they didn't deserve to win last night. They absolutely looked terrible.
Yeah, and even though those there would step up and say that, let me expand on that for a minute in terms of the immediate future. And I agree with you. I had the thought this morning that this is a little like where USA Basketball was after the 2000 Olympics, and Jerry Colangelo comes in as the chairman of USA Basketball and gets everybody, and then the gold medals follow. All right. It seems to me, and I'm still in the novice stage with soccer, even though I have thoroughly loved being a part of Phoenix Rising FC. It seems to me that every time USA Soccer gets in trouble, somebody says, get Bruce Arena on the phone. And nothing against Bruce Arena. He came in very late in this process to take over as head coach. Isn't it time for USA Soccer, step one, to find some bright young coaching star?
Well, I mean, it's sometimes you can only do with the, you know, do with what you can with the talent that you have on the field, right? Or the talent that's in the talent pool. And that's the question is people are always like, how in the United States do we not have a better side? How from this pool that we can draw from that anybody who is a U.S. citizen, you know, whether you play in the United States, or you play overseas somewhere, but you are a U.S. citizen, how do we not have a better, brighter talent pool? So yeah, some of it falls on the coach. Absolutely. Bruce is not a tremendous tactician, but he's a player's coach. He understands players. Some players love to play for him. Some players hate playing for him, but he seemed to have turned around this program since Jurgen Klinsmann got let go. But we all know too, how much of that sometimes is just a change. It's not always the coach that steps in. That was fantastic. It's just, sometimes you need a change. You know, the other coach was not, didn't have the right message, didn't have the right attitude, players didn't like him, whatever it might be. And then that coach could go on somewhere and absolutely dominate. But, you know, it just depends on the relationship. So some of it is the coaching change, and then some of it is just the player pool. And that stems from starting out at a very young age in the club levels. And, you know, a lot has been made about, it's a very expensive sport to play at a club level, and that's the only pool they're drawing from. So from that standpoint, are you really getting the best talent in this country? Are there a ton of players being overlooked because they just can't afford to play on the most expensive clubs where it costs thousands of dollars a year to travel around the country or around the world and play in these big tournaments to get noticed and get in that pool of players? So, you know, there's a lot of different things, and I think it starts at top with Sunil Gulati. I think his time is done, and I think there's going to be a massive overhaul and a massive changing of the guard.
Kendra D. St. Alban, who is works as a color analyst for Minnesota United FC and with Fox Sports. I've got about 30 seconds left. I think it's important to point out to those who are not soccer fans, it's a disastrous loss, but the state of the sport in the U.S. is still pretty good because I see the crowds out at Phoenix Rising FC. And the sport's going to be okay in the U.S. It's just the national team, this is a wake-up call.
Yeah, and like I said, it's those fringe fans that really get drawn into the World Cup, or they only watch the national team, you know, so that helps the rest of soccer, whether it's the USL or MLS or whatever level it might be, indoor soccer, whatever. So, yeah, soccer will be fine. It's just a bummer because there have been made, you know, some huge strides made the last 10 years. And I was at a Phoenix Rising game, you know, over Labor Day weekend, which you know, and the crowd was fantastic, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I think what you guys have going there is phenomenal. They've done it the right way. They've invested in the right players. The field is awesome. Even though you're stuck out in the middle of the desert, it's like you can see people want to come to it and be a part of it. So soccer will absolutely be okay. It's just such a dagger when you felt like it was on the rise, and now it may plateau just a little bit, you know, rather than continuing to take off.
Eric says I got another 30 seconds, so I'm going to ask a follow-up to what you just said. You're around the league on a regular basis because you do the Minnesota matches. What's the chatter been about Phoenix? Because right now the perception is they're gaining in terms of the list of expansion candidates, but they may still be behind Charlotte, Cincinnati, Detroit.
Well, you know what? I think until anybody goes there to experience it, they're not going to understand what Phoenix has. And the first thing everyone brings up to me is the climate. And, you know, that's always going to be the thing. Well, when I was there Labor Day weekend, I think the daytime temperature was 109, and it was beautiful that night at 7 p.m. for kickoff. So until people go there and experience it, and that includes Don Garber, the commissioner of MLS, I think absolutely the following could be fantastic there, and you could do an MLS franchise. But, you know, no one really knows, because people didn't think Atlanta would support an MLS team, and they're getting 40,000 to 70,000 people a game. So, just because there is a good youth system or there is a good minor league system doesn't mean it's going to carry over into MLS or vice versa. If they have nothing there, you never know. Soccer may take off like it did in Atlanta. So I think, you know, the ownership group for Phoenix Rising is doing it the right way. They've invested in the right pieces. They're putting the time and the energy and the money. They've got a good business plan. So I think, you know, Don Garber would be remiss if he didn't take a look at that market for an MLS franchise.
Kendra, good to talk to you. I wish we had more time, but we've got to move along. Safe travels the rest of the schedule. I know there's not that many matches left, but safe travels.
Yep.
And the best to you and the family.
Thank you. Thank you. And, I, you know, we didn't have any time to talk about those Cardinals, but I don't think anybody wants to talk about that.
So. Okay. Take care, Kendra. Good to talk to you.
All right. Thanks, Money. Bye.
Kendra's East St. Albans. I've watched her career grow. I'm so proud of her. And she's just – the sky's the limit for her. You watch Kendra. She's going to – and she will be a part of the World Cup coverage on Fox. You can bank on it. And I don't think – you know, a lot of people are poking a lot of fun at Fox today, saying, well, would they like to get out of covering, you know, showing the World Cup here? And no, come on. They're still going to do okay in the ratings. Yeah, with the U.S., the ratings would have been a lot higher, but they'll be just fine, and everybody will be just fine. You'll be just fine, by the way, if you stay right at this website, sports360az.com or ezcentral.com, because among other things, coming up, talk to the Lopes. Jordan and Haley have guard Casey Benson, who just transferred to Canyon from Oregon. After that, they'll have their Friday Night 360 AZ preview show. This is the place to get all the updated information on high school football. So stick right here. On a Wednesday, the Brad Sesmatch Show. Glad you're with us.
Each and every Wednesday, we have Talk to the Lopes, where we're able to sit down and talk to a member of the GCU Athletic Department. And this week, Jordan Hamm and Haley Stasiak have Casey Benson, senior guard for GCU, spent some time in Oregon playing college ball, also won some state titles with Corona del Sol in high school. First things first, Casey, what's it like being back in Arizona?
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. But no, it's a blast. To be able to come back home is fun. You know, it's exciting, obviously. You know, being able to have the opportunity to play in front of my family and friends for my senior year is wouldn't rather have it any other way.
You've got some familiarity with GCU, with your brother being assistant. But now that you're there, what are your first impressions of practices with Coach Marley?
Oh, I love it. Coach Marley gives us freedom to play, be basketball players, not be robot. He obviously has had a lot of success in his first 4 years at GCU. You know, he's played at the highest level. He's coached at the highest level. So I love playing for him. You know, he, like I said, he gives us the freedom to make plays and within the structure of what we're doing, and he puts us in positions to be successful. It's been a blast so far playing for him.
You spent your last 3 years at the University of Oregon before transferring to GCU. You went to the Final Four with the Ducks right here in Arizona. What did you learn at your time up in Eugene?
You know, just to stay the course. You know, at the end of the day, everybody goes through adversity. You know, everybody goes through tough times. It's kind of the nature of it. And being an athlete, you know, just learning, knowing that it's a marathon, not a sprint. But, you know, I continue to just obviously play with some really good players up there, and so which made me a better player. It was a great experience in my 3 years there. Obviously, you know, had some great runs in the NCAA tournament, won Pac-12 championship. So it was a great experience, you know, had fun doing it. Definitely learned to fight through adversity and, you know, keep a level head.
You've played against some of the best nationally. How do you feel that the state of Arizona stacks up against other well-known basketball states?
No, I think Arizona definitely has a bunch of talent. You know, when I was in high school, there was a lot of good players who have had really good college careers so far. You know, I definitely think that you know, a lot of great players. Obviously, I haven't been around the last couple of years, so. Haven't had a chance to watch high school basketball like I could or like I would like to, but no, I definitely know that there's a lot of good players coming up, and so I'm excited to be able to kind of maybe check out some games this year and check out some of the young talent.
Talking to Casey Benson, GCU senior guard. So this morning, the WAC media and coaches both tabbed GCU as the preseason favorite, as well as Joshua Braun as the preseason player of the year. What's it like sharing the backcourt with Joshua?
Oh, it's great. Me and Josh have known each other since, I think, like the fourth grade or something like that. So So it was kind of cool to kind of just pick up where we left off. We played together when we were younger, so it's fun. We both complement each other very well, and Josh can obviously really, really shoot the basketball, score the basketball, so makes my life a little bit easier. Definitely having him back there to hit shots and make plays. But no, it's fun playing with him. Josh is a great player, a great person, and so we're having a blast.
Midnight Madness last Friday. What was the atmosphere like out there, and does it pump you up for the season?
It was unreal. Unreal. You know, the only thing we're missing is just to have a game. To get the support, to get the as many people that were there for, you know, Midnight Madness, and you know, when, like I said, when there wasn't even a game, was pretty special. You know, obviously, I that was my one time being able to do it, so definitely didn't disappoint. It was a blast, and got me even more excited to play here in a few weeks and get this thing rolling.
You were still in Arizona when Grand Canyon University started the process of becoming a Division I program. And now that they're on the doorstep of postseason eligibility and having that first year of taking that next step, what's the mindset of the team as they start this season?
You know, I mean, I think the mindset's kind of always been the same, win the WAC. You know, and that's our goal, obviously, win the WAC, go to the NCAA tournament, you know, and be the best that we can be, obviously, win the most games that we can possibly win and compete, play as hard as we possibly can every single night out. Winning the WAC is definitely our goal, and going to the NCAA tournament and just seeing what we can do there, trying to make some noise. I definitely think that we have the pieces to do it. You know, got a lot of talent, got a lot of guys that fit nicely within our team, and so our depth is really good, which is a luxury. So it's just a matter of everybody staying healthy and you know, staying ready.
Thanks so much for the time, Casey. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
All right, that was Casey Benson, senior guard over at GCU. The basketball team has a lot of excitement moving into it, their first year of postseason eligibility. Coming up next, we have the Friday Night 360 AZ preview show with Haley and Jordan Hamm. We're going to be previewing plenty, as well as having an interview with Brad Sesmat and Tyler Shuck. He just made a flip to the Oregon Ducks, and he tells us why. That's coming up next on the Friday Night 360 AZ preview show.
Welcome into the Friday Night 360 AZ preview show. Jordan Hamm and Haley Stasiak here with you, previewing week 7. First up, we've got AZ Central Sports Richard Obert with us. Richard, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what are your general impressions of the season so far, as we're just past the midway point?
Well, it's the teams I thought that were going to be there in the beginning of the season are basically making statements now and showing why they belonged all along, like Chandler last week, coming off that great performance against Perry, which had slipped up there to number one, first time in their school history. And then Chandler with everybody back, basically. You got a healthy Jacob Conover, healthy Gunnar Romney, receiver. Their defense is pretty much back to the way it was. I know they're missing one linebacker still, but they made a statement. They really showed that, hey, they're the best team in 6A. And then Centennial, you know, all along everybody thought they were going to be that good, and then when they made that huge statement, national statement, against St. Thomas Aquinas, beating them, shutting them out, that school was shut out for the first time in 21 years. It was like 12-0. So yeah, it's been impressive, you know, the way Centennial has played, the way Chandler has gotten back to where, you know, everybody thought they would be.
When you look at this 4A division, Saguaro's had the stranglehold on that division for about the past half decade. But when you look at the competition this year that they have in that division with Higley, Sal Point, you know, Sunrise Mountain, Cactus, what do you foresee for 4A moving forward as we move towards the playoffs?
Yeah, I see maybe a kind of a four-team, almost you might want to look at a Final Four bracket of Saguaro, Sal Point, Sunrise Mountain, and Higley. You know, I know Saguaro's already played Higley, and they pretty much dominated them. I was at that game, and it wasn't really much of a contest after the first quarter or so, second after the first half. I mean, Saguaro just really, really just basically pulled away in that second quarter. And then when you look at Sunrise Mountain, though, they gave them a really, really tough game. It was their toughest game, in-state game, in a long time. So I think they're right there, and then they've been blowing out teams. And you look at South Point, you know, their only loss was the Cienega, which is a really good 5A team. They're undefeated, and that loss, they didn't have their top two running backs in that game. And I know Padilla and Bijan Robinson were both out with injuries. They're back now, so I think a healthy backfield at South Point, you're going to give Saguaro a lot of trouble.
AZ Central Sports, Richard Obert with us. Are there any teams that have surprised you this year?
You know, I don't know if there. I would say, you know, looking at 6A, I always thought, you know, Chandler, Perry, you know, was where I thought they would be. Mountain Point is where they're at. Desert Ridge, you know, I know they play Mountain Point. They're playing them this weekend. But that's going to be – I didn't think that they would be as good as they are right now. I know they're 6-1. They really haven't had that tough of a schedule. You know, Mount Point game would be a really good indicator. They've had two quarterbacks system over there, and they've been starting like 10 to 11 sophomores. You know, so they're still holding their own. I thought this would be, I think the biggest surprise, though, is Basha, you know, and Brophy being where they're at. You know, they're basically eliminated, and those are two seasoned coaches that never missed the playoffs. You know, Rich Welbrock, what he's done at Desert Edge, and what Scooter Molander at Brophy, what he's done, and they've only won one game, and Bash has only won two games. They have a chance maybe against Hamilton to make some noise, but those have been probably the two biggest surprises, is just what's happened with Brophy and Basha.
You mentioned Basha. You're going to be at Hamilton and Basha this weekend. What do you foresee for this game, and how do you think that Connor Phelan has stepped into the starting quarterback role in the past couple of weeks?
Yeah, it sounds like he's done a great job. He's only been there for 3 weeks now as a quarterback. They've had eight players basically quit the team on Welbrock, so he's basically having to try to, you know, get this program stabilized somehow. The win against the you know, decisive win against Brophy, I think, is a step in the right direction, especially with Connor having a great game. He did over 400 yards, three touchdowns. He's got really good playmakers. They have a lot of speed on that team. You know, he's got some good running backs, and you know, the receiver Tyce Differman there, he's a really talented player. So he's got some good players to get the ball into their hands. If you get those guys in space, they have a chance to make some plays. Hamilton's going to be tough, although the defense, you know, looks like they've gotten better this year than they were last year. Still, that's one of the more high-powered offenses you're going to see in 6A in the state. So it's going to be a tough game. But if they can hang with Hamilton, then I think Welbrock's getting this team back where he needs to.
Looking forward, who is your team to watch as we head into these last few weeks of the regular season?
I'd have to say Liberty in 5A. Just because of what they just did to Chaparral, I think that might have been the worst loss in Chaparral history. If it wasn't, it was one of them. You know, putting up 63 points on them, and the defense, the way they're playing, the offense, the way they're playing right now. I know they got Jet Kinch he's eligible now. That was a big pickup for them, a transfer that had to miss the first five games due to the transfer rule. I think he had something like 110 yards on 10 carries against Chaparral. So that beefs up their offense and makes them even more of a threat with the run game. And then the passing of Ryan Bindo, it only was like five or six, but all five of his completions went for touchdowns against Chaparral. So I think Liberty is going to make a little bit of noise. I think Centennial is going to have to worry about that team when it gets down to I think they play each other the last game of the regular season. So, you know, I have a feeling that they could be, you know, everybody thought, well, maybe they're a little rebuilding this year because new quarterback, you know, they moved the receiver to quarterback. So I'm kind of waiting to see if Liberty really does break out and give Centennial a game.
Richard, thanks for coming on with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Interesting stuff there with his comment on Liberty being the kind of team that he's watching. I mean, we've discussed Liberty a little bit, but obviously that big win against Chaparral. So good stuff that.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to just how good 5A is. We've talked multiple times on this show about just how deep it is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's probably safe to say Centennial's the front runner, that they're the kind of the standard right now. But, you know, you do have those five or six teams, and you have a very talented team in Chaparral, very talented, but a very young team. Mm-hmm. And what Liberty was able to do, I mean, like he said, it 63-6, I believe, was the score. So just dominating really from the get-go. You know, they closed the door, and it seems like they're a team that's starting to put things together. And, you know, late in the season, you want everything to click. And that's exactly what's happening with Liberty.
Coming up next, we're going to break down week 7. And then we have Brad Sesmat, who talked with Tyler Shuck earlier this week. Welcome back into the Friday Night 360 AZ Preview Show. Haley Stasiak and Jordan Hamm here with you. We are breaking down Week 7 matchups. Jordan, let's start out with Desert Ridge at Mountain Point. Mountain Point's obviously got quarterback Nick Wallerstedt, who is a dual threat. And then, for me, the biggest thing that the Jaguars are going to have to combat is Mountain Point's defense. You've got Tyree Johnson, Kenny Churchwell, and Shamari Hayes, who are going to be a threat to that offense.
Yeah, shocker. Mountain Point has a good defense. I don't think that's happened in the past couple of years or anything like that. But yeah, they have a ton of playmakers on the defensive side of the ball. Kenny Churchwell, I think, was a guy that was overshadowed a little bit last year by Isaiah Polamau in that secondary. He's really kind of, for lack of a better term, spread his wings. But he's been a playmaker all over the place the past couple of years. And Norris Vaughn's teams are very good in the trenches on the offensive side of on the offensive line, on the defensive line, and that's just their bread and butter. Desert Ridge has had a nice year so far. Especially they've had to combat a lot of youth on that team. Coach Hathcock told me that they had something like 13 sophomores starting this year at various points. Wow. So they've had a lot of youth, but they're sitting at 6-1 right now. Their remaining three games, though, against Mountain Point, Desert Vista, and Highland, that's a combined 16-5 record. So going to be a tough stretch for them as they continue their season.
Marana at Post and Butte. You were down at Marana earlier this year and spoke with head coach Andy Litton. What was it that he told you about this team that's clicking?
Well, that they have experience now. Last year, they started the year 0-2 and ended the year 9-3. And going through that process, it's almost an exact mirror of what they did last year, where they started 0-2 against some very good competition, but now are just rattling off win after win. Trenton Bourget is the quarterback over there. I think he's one of the more underrated quarterbacks in this state. Can do a little bit with the legs, but has a huge arm, takes care of the football as well. And then Teon Simmons is a receiver for them. He has 20 receptions on the year, and 13 of them have gone for touchdowns. So that's pretty efficient there.
For Post and Butte, the Tigers are going to have to stop the run game. Connor McDonald, Larry Tripp, and Tyler Thompson are all key guys for the Broncos that they will have to look out for. Desert Vista Highland. I've mentioned in previous shows when I saw Desert Vista match up against Perry, I was a little shocked and kind of weary about the rest of the season, but the record has shown improvements. Their only losses are to Perry and Mountain Point. Highland also has two losses, however, to those exact same teams. So it's going to be a really interesting matchup. They lost to Mountain Point last week 14-13 with the final score there. Keeping an eye on these offenses, though, because Highland is a run-heavy team and Desert Vista's Derek Klein is a dual threat. So it's going to be interesting to see how these defenses adjust and stop these offenses.
Yeah, Derek Klein has bounced back nicely since that first week where he struggled. 13 touchdowns, 3 interceptions, very efficient as a passer. Also the team's leading rusher. So getting it done both on the ground and in the air for Desert Vista.
Cactus at Higley. Both of these teams are also run heavy. Demaria Norris for Cactus is over 1,100 rushing yards, and then Drayson Hall for Higley has just over 800.
Yeah, and these are two of the best running backs you're going to see in this state. Here's a stat for you. The two have combined for 9,755 total yards in their careers. That's rushing and receiving. They can do a little bit of everything in their offensive systems and have been playing. They're very seasoned as well. They've been in the case of Hall, I believe he played a little bit as a freshman and has worked his way up. Same thing with Norris. He had a great sophomore year and has just been kind of the staple of that Cactus offense as well. So two very good stat fillers in this game. These guys are probably under-recruited right now, and it might be, at least in the case of Hall, because of his size, he's a little bit smaller. He picked up a U of A offer. That was his first Power 5 offer a couple weeks ago. I think the offers are going to come for both of those guys moving forward.
Desert Mountain at Horizon, you are heading out to this game. What are you looking out for?
Well, it's going to be a couple of really good offenses. Desert Mountain can put up points, but in losses, they're giving up 60 points a game on defense. In wins, they're giving up 28. So Horizon has a lot of talent, a lot of experience up front as well. Nash Giffen making plays on both sides of the ball. He's a running back, the team's leading tackler as well. On Desert Mountain side, Josh Walker is a huge playmaker for them. Horizon's going to have to limit that. And it's an interesting scenario here for Horizon. They were sitting at this exact same record, 6-1, at this point last year, and they lost their last three games, didn't make the postseason. So So they're going to, they have a, it's Desert Mountain, Boulder Creek, and then Pinnacle. So three pretty big games coming up. Obviously a ton more experience this year. I really like their quarterback as well. He's a dual threat guy. So we'll see how the rest of the year shakes out for them.
That does it for our Week 7 breakdown. Be sure to use the Friday Night 360 AZ hashtag this Friday night and all season long.
And coming up next, we have Tyler Shuck with Brad Sesmat. Tyler Shuck, one of the top quarterbacks in the entire nation, the Hamilton QB. He just flipped his commitment from North Carolina and Oregon. He tells Brad Sesmat why coming up next on the Friday Night 360 AZ preview show.
All right, let's shift gears now over to the high school platform. Huge news on the recruiting front over the weekend where Tyler Shuck, a year ago, Tyler Shuck was coming onto radar screens across the country. He committed to North Carolina last spring, but over the weekend, he decided to go a different direction. He Skypes on in with us now to talk about not only his decision to decommit from North Carolina and commit to Oregon, but also the season the Hamilton Huskies are having under Dick Banaszewski. They play Basha this coming Friday night. All right, let's walk right through this. When did you decide it was time to decommit from North Carolina and become an Oregon Duck?
I mean, I've had a strong feeling the past kind of month. They offered me about a month ago, and they've been pushing really hard since. And, you know, that's my mom's from there. I've had strong connections there, so I wanted to get out on a visit. And I visited this past, you know, week or so, and just got to connect with the coaches and the team. And, you know, I fell in love with it. And, you know, I just thought it was overall best fit for me and my family going forward.
The news to give to North Carolina, Tyler, how difficult a call was that?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, you know, the uncomfortable conversations. But, you know, I was kind of, you know, used to it, those conversations. I mean, it wasn't hard, it wasn't easy, but, you know, I just got to do what you got to do. And, you know, I mean, they were understanding. You know, obviously it's disappointing for them, but, you know, sometimes you got to, you know, step up and, you know, make that right call. And hopefully, you know, they can understand and they'll be better off for it. And, you know, I'll be better off for it as well. Just got to break the ties.
And the big news here is you gave them plenty of heads up. This is not a flip like a day before letter of intent day. So for both sides, I mean, you've handled it the right way. Talk a little further then, if you could, about the connection with Oregon, with family, and what mm-hmm. was their pitch to you?
So yeah, my mom was born in Springfield. It's the town right across Eugene, and you know, I've grown up a Duck fan, a huge Duck fan, and obviously watching them all the time. Been out to Oregon a couple times now, but I mean, their pitch really, I mean, it wasn't really focused on that. I mean, obviously I'm a West Coast kid, but you know, their pitch was mainly, you know, they want me to come lead this class that they have. They're building, you know, great group of kids, and I just fell in love with the coaching staff as well, the experience that they've had. Their coaching styles, what they kind of do on and off the field. You know, I really fell in love with it, and I think they're heading in the right direction, and I wanted to be a part of it.
When you look at staying in the Pac-12, and as you said, being a West Coast kid, and I visited with you some, and I think being on the West Coast in the back of your mind was always there, even when you committed North Carolina. Am I wrong on that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you're completely right. I mean, you know, I like the South, but, you know, obviously I was born in the West Coast, watching the Pac-12, and it's better for my family as well. I'll get to stay and play those West Coast teams. And, you know, my grandparents are talking about moving to Oregon already. So they're pretty excited about it. But I think it's just a better fit overall. And that's kind of what I've intended in the long haul to do as well.
Okay, so you're committed to Oregon. You are going to leave school at the break, right?
Yes, sir.
So let's get into that a little bit, because I don't know if the audience is really aware how popular a trend that is. The advantage of leaving school in December, are you planning on coming back and walking at Hamilton in May, or are you just saying this is it?
So, yeah, they'll give you the option to, you can go to prom, you can walk with your classmates, but, you know, it's a difficult process. You know, my whole summer was, you know, 6 hours a day of homework, of classes, and, you know, a lot of athletes do it too, but, you know, it's well worth it, you know, if you take the time to do it. So I was taking classes over the summer, and then I have half days now at Hamilton. So I'll be set up to graduate in December, and then I'll enroll full time in college in January at Oregon then. And then you'll get a whole another spring ball, a whole another 15 practices, and you just get a head start on the playbook and everything like that.
You and I are sitting here today talking. You're 6'5"?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And you're two. What are you at? Two bills?
I'm really close to 200 right now. I mean, I've been traveling a lot. I mean, just kind of jumping. But once you get in that groove, I've hit like 200. So trying to get there.
Yeah, and so you've got room on your frame. What I'm getting at here is, by leaving school in December and getting those extra practices, they're going to be able to work with you, and a year from now, you're going to be a completely different physical specimen, I would think.
Sir. Yeah.
And that's really the goal here, right?
Yeah, I'm excited for it. You know, you're going to be in full-time college. They got, you know, structured weight room. You're going to be basically it's a job. So obviously I'll have the opportunity to put on weight there. I mean, even from last year, I've gained a whole bunch of weight, confidence, you know, just in my quarterback style. So I'm really excited for it, though. And it'll definitely benefit.
Okay, before we get out of here, let's talk about what's going on this season on the field for you at Hamilton. And the Huskies, I think, quietly have had themselves pretty darn good season given all the turmoil in the off season. Let's talk about what's gone on this year for Hamilton.
Right. I mean, nothing's changed really for us. I mean, behind our doors, we're just doing our best, working really hard. And the whole, like you said, the turmoil, it's really made us closer. And you know, we've gained a lot of confidence from it. You know, we feel like our backs are against the wall every week. You know, it's their biggest game, and we got to play our hardest. And we got to step up and do the right job for our guys. And each week, there's a whole other universe. You know, you never know who's going to play. Just like, you know, Chandler Bean, Perry, whatever steps up. You know, it's a whole different universe. So I'm really excited for it. We can't take anybody lightly, and just go week by week.
Okay, and Dick Banaszewski, the coach this season, talk about the job that he has done for the program and what you've seen, Tyler.
He's a great man, just to start off. We all really love him. Truly, he's a great coach as well. He's inspired us truly, and none of this has been even close to being possible without him and with his leadership that he's done for the program and the whole school, that, you know, everyone's on board. And even the classmates and our teachers, you know, they really enjoy coming out to the games and supporting us. So, you know, it's been a lot of fun so far, but, you know, you're only as good as your next win. So we're just planning on Basher this week and got to keep moving.
Yeah, the backyard rivalry being renewed. What do you see in the game this Friday night? They're in a rebuilding mode. They had a big win over Brophy, but Basher, your opponent this Friday.
Right. You know, they're coming off hot. You know, they're feeling really good right now. And, you know, we got to step up to the test. We're going to play as well against Brophy. So we just got to do our jobs, execute our plan, and hopefully we can come out with a win this Friday.
Good stuff. Congratulations on the decision and everything in front of you. Thanks.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you for having me.
There's Tyler Shuck with us via Skype talking about what's gone on at Hamilton, and Tyler now going on to the University of Oregon. Thanks for checking out this podcast on Sports360AZ.com, brought to you by your Valley Hyundai dealers.